This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this. You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
It's the 1st of June, 2012, just after 4 in the afternoon, and we're going to hop right into it. We got to smash the state report. Starting off with more just Huck Farper, man. Huh, man, Huck Farper. The federal government plans to break up a team of Environment Canada smokestack specialists that played a key role working with enforcement officers and industry to crack down on toxic pollution. Details of the cuts emerged through a series of leaked documents and interviews that revealed members of the Ottawa-based groups of scientists were told their current roles would be eliminated over the next year. That makes a lot of sense, don't it? Yeah. The Union of Environment Workers has described the Emissions Research and Measurement Unit as a unique team that provides expertise that is not available from other sources. No big surprise there. Continuing attack by the Harper government on environmental standards. Speaking about that, we got a Rabble.ca article by Jamie Keane. And it's a post on the Mining Watch blog on rabble.ca. Not going to read it all, just going to kind of introduce it, then hop through it. Federal budgets weren't always this controversial. Sure, there was a tough public debate around the financial direction of the government was taking, but that was all. Radical changes to environmental governance, public services, and the whole concept of the public interest, that is quite new. It's hard to know which is more worrying, the systematic trashing of environmental and social safeguards, or the anti-democratic way it is being done. Not only is the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act being repealed and replaced with a few slices of Swiss cheese, but the Fisheries Act is being cut into bait, the National Roundtable on the Environment and Economy is being axed, and scientific and environmental protection capacity is to be cut, along with a vast array of other cuts to democratically important public institutions. Everything from putting down the CSIS watchdog to repealing the Fair Wages and Hours of Labor Act. But really, these are just two aspects of the same issue, whether government decision-making should be in the public interest or just respond to special interest groups. In this case, domestic and foreign investors. If cabinet ministers, the investors, and the market knows best, then there's no need for scientific research on ecosystems, economies, or human societies, and there's certainly no need for the public interest research groups either, or even the public at large, to be involved in decision making. The reality is that things don't actually work that way. The profit motive does not protect anything that is not directly profitable, whether that's a worker on disability or a fish on a spawning bed in a wilderness river. That's why we have these laws and regulations. This article notes. The article then hops into, you can check it out on rabble.ca, the article hops into kind of the core arguments of the conservatives of why we need to change the Environmental Assessment Act so much. It has to be as part of the budget because it's really, really important that it has to be done right now, even though that a review was ordered 2 years ago and nothing has materialized on that review. One of the other arguments is for harmonization. Well, it's been trying to do, but this new act actually is being, it dices up and makes it so there'll be multiple assessments under multiple jurisdictions, confusing the process. It'll kind of simplify federal involvement, they say. Reduce the number of assessments, especially on the smaller ones, you know, because somehow small equals environmentally benign in the eyes of some. Some things about timelines, how they go on for too long. Well, maybe we need to discuss projects and developments and the way things are going. And the final one is foreign-funded radicals are interfering with the process. And we don't need to really talk about how that is. That's just a red herring in the argument, as most of the developments are foreign-funded. So even if it was true, which it's not true, that all the opposition to tar sands development and pipeline development were from foreign countries, also is the money for those projects, so yeah, it doesn't really matter. Well, check out the rest of the article. I mean, it's an interesting piece because they're trying to absolutely just gut the Environmental Assessment Act, the Fisheries Act, in this new budget. And if you want a little more in-depth view, check out this article by in Ravel.ca, shining a light on the federal government's false claims on environmental assessment and the budget. Disappointing information from the labor front. Greed comes first. CP rail strikers ordered back to work. Hey, it's all about the economy, right? Well, maybe not so much. Earlier this week, Conservative Labor Minister Lisa Raitt introduced Bill C-39, back-to-work legislation targeting striking Canadian Pacific Railroad engineers and conductors, the TCRC. It's the sixth time in 5 years that the federal government has issued back-to-work legislation that effectively defeats the bargaining position of unionized employees. In this particular instance, the Teamster Union is being told that they can't strike because not moving freight in and out of the country is negatively impacting Canada's economic recovery. Keeping corporate profits going, an essential service? So in a nutshell, this federal government has decided, after only a week of striking, that rail engineers and conductors perform an essential service, much like nurses, doctors, firefighters, and paramedics, and can be denied their right to strike. Of course, rail engineers and conductors don't save lives on a routine basis. They move people and valuable freight that helps keep corporate profit margins on the rise. In essence, Minister Raitt is telling us that keeping the wheels of corporate profit greased is now deemed an essential service. CP reported record profits in the first quarter of 2012. The rail business is a big moneymaker. According to striking locomotive engineer John Cochin, CP is crying poor. Quote, they want to cut pension benefits for employees, Cochin says. Not only that, they want to cut the benefits of retirees, people who've worked and paid into the plan and are now retired and using pension benefits that were negotiated while they still worked for CP, Cohen added. A retired locomotive engineer could lose up to $13,000 per year in benefits. Quote, CP wants to take money we've earned and put into the pockets of its shareholders. CP representatives have yet to respond to a request for an interview. When asked about service interruptions caused by the labor action, Cochin said that keeping passenger service going is TCRC's idea, yeah. Quote, CP was against keeping passengers' train going. They wanted to make us look bad and turn public opinion against us, but the government convinced CP to keep moving people during the strike. With a grin, he added, of course both the government and CP were falling over each other, trying to take credit for keeping people moving, unquote. Back-to-work legislation threatens whole collective bargaining system. Locomotive engineers and conductors aren't the only ones who need to negotiate a collective agreement with Canadian Pacific Railroad. The Teamsters Rail Maintenance Workers Division is poised to enter into negotiations with the rail company this July. Teamster President Bill Brail is carefully monitoring the outcome of the strike. Quote, our local will probably be facing the same problems as the TCRC, but we'll be turning our strategies based on what happens here. Brail has serious concerns about C-39, which passed the Senate on. Back-to-work legislation thwarts the whole collective bargaining system. It will always favor the employer because it removes the union's right to withhold their service, the only tool we have once talks break down. If an employer understands that back-to-work is forthcoming, they can sit back and let the government disarm the union. This kind of legislation may end a strike, but it does not ensure labor peace and, in fact, usually increases the unrest that is already present, unquote. All of this comes back to the heels of criticism that the government's budget bill, C-38, represents an attack on working people. Minister Raitt recently announced changes to the Employment Insurance Act that would further restrict EI claims by changing eligibility guidelines. The new EI legislation is being labeled punitive, unfairly targeting the unemployed and underemployed. Bill C-38 attacks on working people and the environment. Other changes to labor legislation include the repealing of the Fair Wages and Hours Act, a move that Raitt says will cut unnecessary red tape. What it actually ensures is that contractors bidding for federal projects will no longer be required to pay fair wages or overtime to their employees. This will largely affect skilled and semi-skilled trades and construction workers. Additionally, employers of migrant workers will be permitted to pay their workers less than the current minimum, a move that they say will lower wages across the board. For Bill Brail, it's all about greed, apparently. Quote, for sure, It will lower the bar for everyone. It's called a minimum wage for a reason. It is a standard, and not a very high one, in my opinion. And it's a standard for everyone. It means that the law will not allow the employer to pay anyone below the standard. If they could, almost all employers would pay lower wages to their employees. The unions, as well as the fears of unions coming, and the minimum wage are all that prevents this. There must always be an hourly wage that they cannot sink below, no matter how far down their ethics and human decency have dipped. Once an employer is allowed to reduce the wage of one set of employees, they will keep trying to bring the others down as well. Greed is an insatiable animal, unquote. Lest you think that C-38, the budget bill, is primarily throwing working people under the bus, it also dismantles much of Canada's environmental protection legislation. Quote, this government is taking environmental protection back 100 years, unquote, says Council of Canadians Maude Barlow, all so that the corporate for-profit sector can more easily exploit our precious resources. The Green Party is also deeply concerned about how environmental protection is being undermined, quote, to clear the way for resource extraction, unquote. It would appear that C-38 sacrifices the environment to corporate greed, apparently all in the name of, quote, ensuring Canada's economic recovery. Among the legislations to be changed or eliminated to accommodate the corporate sector are the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, the Canadian Environmental Protection Act, the Fisheries Act, and the Kyoto Protocol Implementation Act. The Harper majority would have us believe a false dichotomy. A healthy economy is at odds with rights, freedoms, and the environment. Labor Minister Lisa Raitt has made it clear that workers' rights and wages are to be sacrificed for the sake of a, quote, healthy and stable economy. Last time I checked, lowering wages had the opposite effect. It negatively impacts a country's economy. We only have to look south of the border with the U.S. to confirm that. Meg Borthwick is a freelance writer and moderates Rabble.ca's discussion forum, Babble. Babble.ca. And the union of Bill Brell is a TCRC MWED. And the TCRC has been ordered back to work. Greed always comes first. We're going to a song. This one is Byron, Don't Trust the Boss, here on AWOL Radio.
His lies, know he's just exploiting you and using your time. Know you should take all that you need, either from the shop or from the cash machine. Don't let him tell you how you need to act. Tell him you quit and never go back. Don't trust the boss and don't do what he said. His time will be over soon, come the day. Into a cop, kick him in the shins, run away, don't stop. Gotta get away so you can fight again another day. Come back tomorrow and blow him away. Pigs are just thugs, they're up to no good. Just causing shit in your neighborhood. Don't trust the cops and don't do what they say. Their time will be over, soon come the day. Go back to school, don't follow no teacher, don't follow no rules. Know you can learn outside of class. You don't need to pay, and you don't need to pass. Don't trust the teachers or the knowledge they guard. If you really want to learn, get a library card. Don't trust the teachers, don't do what they say. Their time will be over, soon come the day. Thank you. singing this song. You might like the singing, you might hum along, but if you don't like the words that I say, that's fine by me, you can go your own way. Don't let me tell you how you need to be. Think for yourself and that's how you get free. Don't trust the singing, don't do what I say. My time will be over, soon come the day. My time will be over, soon come the day.
The Smash the State report here on AWOL Radio. Clashes over Sextra mine in Peru leave two dead. Sextrada mine in Peru, sorry. At least two people were killed in Peru when police used tear gas to put down a demonstration against Swiss-owned Sextrada staged by striking miners and townspeople, officials said. Prime Minister Oscar Valdez declared a state of emergency late Monday, saying it was needed to, quote, safeguard public security and allow free transit, unquote, after the two were killed and a provincial prosecutor was briefly kidnapped. Valdez said at a press conference in Lima that the 30-day decree limiting personal freedoms was necessary because it is not a peaceful demonstration. It's extremists who are attacking the police. Oh no! 50 people were injured on Monday, including 30 police, according to Interior Minister Wilver Calle. Hundreds of demonstrators had lugged tree trunks and boulders into roads in Espinar area of Cusco in southern Peru to protest what they say is the mining company's pollution of the Salado and Canipia rivers. They are demanding environmental studies, citing local animal deaths. They also want the company to increase from 3 to 30% the amount of earnings it invests in local economic development. It is the eighth day of the demonstration that have left at least 70 people injured. Activist Herbert Huelman on the front of the defense of Espinar said 42 protesters had been wounded with some serious conditions after being shot by police. And an interesting one from an American blogger, Bhaskar Sunkara. Reading Lolita in Montreal, Canada doesn't want more journalists on inthesetimes.com. There weren't any bright lights or street positions, but it was definitely an interrogation. Crossing over to Canada yesterday, I had the unusual experience of being detained for a few hours. I started off innocently enough. I filed off a Montreal-bound Greyhound bus at the border with a few dozen others to go through customs. As usual, I was paid extra attention. Security officials may notice me because I look suspiciously Muslim. But it's a small price to pay for having enough melanin to pull off a salmon-colored blazer. Reasonably, a border official asked me why I was visiting Canada. Mostly sightseeing, I said. Did I know anyone in the city? Sure, I had a few friends who went to McGill. That struck the agent as bizarre. How could someone from New York come to Quebec City? Do you use the internet, he said. What? Was I carrying more than $10,000 in cash? I wish. Does that mean I should search your things for that money? Next time, I guess I'll save my charm for a more receptive audience. It was all going well enough until I was asked what I did for a living. I said that I just graduated from university on Sunday. Oh, so you're unemployed. That's where they got me. My precarious employment is a personal point of pride. Of course, I wasn't unemployed. I do administrative work and write on occasion. Probably shouldn't have left out that last part. I was whisked away from my lovely new bus friends. I had assumed that Canada's law enforcement would be like Vermont's. Only I've never been to Vermont, so I suppose I had assumed Canada's cops would be like the cast and crew of Super Troopers. I was mistaken. Oh, man. Two different officers greeted me in the next room and went through my baggage, clothes and personal effects, one book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, and two magazines, a copy of In These Times and Jacobin. The guard flipped through Jacobin easily enough, admired our art, and took it to be some sort of smarmy cultural publication. All good there. Reading Lolita in Tehran did, however, raise eyebrows. A burly cop asked me why I had the book. I said I was rereading it, and mentioned what the book was about. He didn't really get it. Why so much interest in Tehran? How many times have you been to Iraq? What? Never. I held back a smile, mostly because this guy was armed and terrifying. The other agent, now done examining my roll of dental floss, flipped through my copy of In These Times, and saw my name on the masthead, So you're a big-time journalist. You must be embedded in the student movement, right? Ah, this was the surprise, and to be honest, it was kind of refreshing. For the first few years of my adult life, I've dealt with an extra screenings at airports and crossings, mostly outside the United States, particularly in the European countries I visit. It was due to my race. My first hour in Canada was like that. Now I was being harassed because I was a leftist, going to possibly talk to people in a country terrified of militant left-wing movement. And I was a known journalist. I couldn't wait to brag to my friends. They asked me if I had two identities. No, of course not. How come you have all these medical cards that say Swami Sankara on them? I tried to explain the United States employer-based healthcare system and how young people under a certain age were under their parents' coverage. You know a lot about this. Are you political? The irony was striking. The system I was explaining was a stark reminder of America's weak social safety net. It was foreign to the Canadian border officials, who were admittedly not too bright, but it was one of the reasons why so many were marching in the streets of Montreal, to halt the neoliberal offensive. The border officials didn't want me to join the protesters, but they also didn't want my health care. I was taken to another room, where I was met with an agent of higher rank. Hour two approaches. He questions me about me being a writer and asks who I'm going to interview in Montreal. I'm not sure, I tell him. I'm probably just going to take the easy route and write about getting detained at the border instead. Where was I staying in Montreal? A hostel? A hotel? Where? I had to pull up the information on my phone. He seemed satisfied. Then, we're not going to let you through unless I can take a look through your phone and see who you have been contacting. This guy's good. I don't keep texts from activists. I also delete any sensitive emails. So I agreed. They looked through my phone for an hour and spent lots of time on Google. They were cautious, but maybe they have a reason to be afraid. Downtown Montreal is the scene of a continuous class struggle, with constant demonstrations that show no sign of slowing down. The government has its hands full with activists, journalists, and intellectuals they already have. Why would they want more radicals in the country? Finally, the verdict. You can enter the country, but you have to leave on Thursday. I wasn't granted a visa, but rather a visitor's pass. Avoid the bad protest elements. Stick to the girls at McGill instead, eh, kid? And don't write while you're in Canada. Again, that was Bakshar Sankara in These Times, inthesetimes.com, called Reading Lolita in Montreal. Canada doesn't want more journalists. And we reported on it, but now it's official, that Obama had launched the Stuxnet program, the terrifying worm that went through the cyberspace and destroyed networks around the world trying to take down Iran's nuclear program. He called it, codenamed Olympic Games. I guess it basically got out of their control. They created this this Trojan and it just got out of control. An amazing news from Japan, and while we may have talked about it on an earlier episode, there's just it was tweeted a couple weeks ago, or retweeted this awesome post from submedia.tv called Amateur Riot. And this one was put up right before, or right after Christmas last year. And since then, so in the last few months, you know, and this was dispatch two of the Stop the Flows project, but it's the anti-nuke movement in Japan. So in the last 5 months, in the last 4 months, basically, 4.5 months, they were able to shut down the nuclear industry in Japan. Shut it down completely. They turned them off. They turned them all off. It's amazing. And one of the groups that participated and one of the groups that are bringing a really fresh sense of resistance in Japan is a group called Amateur Riot. So check out submedia.tv's post on Amateur Riot and just think, like, since it was reported on, it's done. Like it took a major disaster that's toxifying the planet, but so is the coal industry and so is the nuclear industry here. We can shut that down too. Pretty good action that happened last week or last, I guess it was a week ago Thursday, and we didn't report on it. I was waiting for a big report back, but I couldn't find one. About 40 people showed up for this equal pay for equal work protest in front of Peter Braid's office. The Conservative government has given employers in Canada more rein to exploit migrants. Employers can now pay migrant workers 15% below the average wage. This is an outrage. To discriminate on wages simply on the basis of nationality is unfair. Considering that most migrant workers are people of color, this wage cut is simply racist. The Migrant Workers Alliance for Change, a community labor alliance of over 40 organizations, did demonstrate at MP Joe Oliver's office on May 24th. So there was protests at Oliver's office, in Peter Braid's office in Kitchener-Waterloo, in London outside of Susan Troop's office, and in Vancouver outside of Wei Young's office. Migrant Workers Alliance for Change demands a right to landing status be granted upon arrival for migrant workers. They must not be tied to one employer, be required to live in their employer's home, or be subject to further medical examination. A right to equal access for all social programs, including employment insurance, health care, settlement services, social service, and worker compensation. A right to a fair appeal process for migrant workers prior to a pre-removal order, and a stop to deportations until this process is in place. A right to full protection under the Provincial Employment Standards Act and regulations, currently enjoyed by Canadian citizens and permanent residents, including no fees for any work placement. And finally, immediately implement a national regularization program granting permanent immigration status for all non-residents living in Canada. And again, that's from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. And shame on the Peter Braid and the Conservative government for passing these very racist legislation. I mean, the doctors have been protesting Joe Oliver's office around this, as well as refugees have been targeted with the health care services being cut for them, or most of them. Well, a call out from Julian Eckham, and it happened this Monday, a big old turnout for Kelly Flugback's sentencing, which was delayed now until July 13th or something. So Kelly has been a fierce inspiration as an anti-poverty activist in creating harm reduction programs for street-involved youth, and has also been involved in solidarity with Indigenous struggles across Turtle Island for the defense of their territories. She has been targeted by the police and the media as being one of the sole authors of the so-called mayhem on the Toronto streets during the Toronto G20 protests, and has had to endure one of the most restrictive bail conditions since her release from pretrial custody, including several months on house arrest and curfew. No public demonstration conditions and non-association with many dozens of people, including her closest friends and comrades. Last Monday, it was made clear to the courts that Kelly is not alone in the face of this ongoing criminalization of dissent that has heavily impacted our communities in resistance. We were there to support her in court, her family, and friends during this difficult period. She will continue to be an inspiration to her friends, comrades, and community at large, and that this conviction will only serve to further our solidarity, love, and rage against this broken and bankrupt system. If one falls, 10 shall rise up. Marichiwu. And that was posted on julianickham.wordpress.com, but also on the wcctoronto.wordpress.com, and I believe it came from there originally. For more information on the case, check out an awesome interview that was done by Comrade Black. And it was, it's called Behind the Black Mask and Shattered Glass. Pre-sentencing interview with the G20 arrestee Kelly Flugback by Comrade Black. And it's on Profane Existence. It's also being posted up on the Vancouver Media Co-op, on InfoShop News, and all over the place. Because Kelly is an inspiration. And the work that she did in organizing in Guelph, in any community that she's been in, is an inspiration. Her ongoing resistance and ongoing... her ongoing resistance is amazing, and her spirit is an inspiration. So she keeps it going, and they don't have her yet. Sentencing has been delayed until July 13th, as the Crown, Liz Nadeau, who has been notoriously going after people on just ridiculous things, saying Kelly was basically the leader of the Black Bloc. This is Liz Nadeau, who also said, "I was the leader of the Black Bloc, and I organized the whole thing." in Ryan Rainville's courts. So I think Liz Nadeau needs to get her, like, who was, are we all the leaders, or are, like, how many leaders are there in the Black Bloc? Liz Nadeau, it's a question. I believe it's a fair question. I certainly was not a leader of the G20 Toronto Black Bloc. I was busy picking up my friends who were traumatized after their houses had been raided or their taxis had been pulled over and armed police swarmed their taxis to arrest other friends. So, you know, Nadeau, get your shit straight. Kelly Flug back. Amazing inspiration getting back to it. And check out the interview once again on profaneexistence.org. Behind the Black Mask and Shattered Glass. Pre-sentencing interview with G20 RSD Kelly Flugback by Comrade Black. And I'm sure we mentioned it, but in case we didn't, Byron Soane was found completely innocent of all charges. Awesome. Just awesome. The smile on his face as he walked out of the courtroom was huge. And it's very nice. All of the ridiculous arguments put forth by the Crown prosecutors and all of the ridiculous evidence put forth by Detective Tambui. It's bananas. Awesome work, people that covered the Byron Soane case. Good work, Byron, on keeping spirits up through so much harm that was put on his life by the police for his dissent against the security state and this rising wave of fascism. G20 senior commander facing misconduct charges for ordering U of T mass arrest. Speaking about fascism. Toronto Police Inspector Gary Messiner is facing disciplinary action for ordering the early morning raid and unlawful mass arrests at the University of Toronto during the G20 summit 2 years ago, the Toronto Star has learned. In a 120-page report, the province's police complaint watchdog alleges Meissner was responsible for one of the most embarrassing errors committed by the police during the G20. On June 27, 2010, he failed to obtain a proper warrant before officers under his command barged into a U of T gym and arrested more than 100 people, all of whom later had their charges withdrawn due to the oversight. Oh, and that they didn't do anything. In a report dated March 2011, a House of Commons Standing Committee condemned the U of T operation. While it has been previously reported that Meissner is one of two senior police officers facing misconduct charges, it was unclear what the allegations were against him until now. He was also in charge of deploying the long-range acoustic device at Queen's Park. The Office of the Independent Police Review Director is recommending charges be laid against Meissner under the Police Services Act. The charges are not criminal, and Meissner has not yet had the opportunity to defend himself against the allegations. If the charges are upheld, penalties range from dock pay to termination. And of course, those arrests were just, it was a disgusting incident where a mass arrest took place of people sleeping in a gym because they were French, basically. Another report, well, from the OIPRD report as well, the G20 report, police more violent than protesters. Stats on police and protester violent compared from Enid Godfrey of the Toronto Media Co-op, toronto.mediacoop.ca. Police violence was likely more prevalent than protester violence during the G20, according to a report recently released by the OIPRD. While media reports on the G20 protests have focused heavily on protester violence and vandalism, the OIPRD report shows that there were more complaints that police used excessive force than reports that police were injured during the G20. An internal police review completed after the G20 found that 97 officers were injured in the course of carrying out their duties, while the internal report ties only two of these injuries to protesters. The OIPRD report also outlines a number of instances of protesters throwing projectiles at police. That didn't hurt them too much, apparently. I guess the projectiles must not have been big enough. In addition to police injuries, 330 assorted criminal charges, not all for violence, were laid against protesters and bystanders, with 201 of them being stayed, withdrawn, or dismissed. A remaining 32 people pled guilty to a host of charges, while another 50 had their charges diverted or were subject to peace bonds. 34 charges are outstanding. This contrasts sharply with the stats on police use of force in the OIPRD report. 356 complaints were made to the OIPRD, with 129 that complained of excessive use of force by the police. Of the original 356 complaints, 119 were substantiated by the OIPRD. That's more than people that were arrested that had their charges actually put forth and not withdrawn. The CBC has reported that the OIPRD has recommended charges against 45 of the police. And it goes on. As we're saying, smash the state report here on AWOL Radio. And we're trying to get through this. We have a piece from Russia Today. Anarchy versus London Olympics. Radicals prepare for war on police state. Anarchists in Britain don't want rich tourists. They want civil war. As the London Olympics draw near, those flying the black flag are going for gold in sabotage. On the eve of the Olympic Games, the FAI seems fired up by the unprecedented security measures being taken by the British police. The British cell of the Italian anarchist group finds the escalating police state frankly offensive. In line with their ideological convictions, the games set for July are viewed as a rightful cause to act. Quote, we have no inhibition to use guerrilla activity to hurt the national image and paralyze the economy however we can, because simply we don't want rich tourists, we want civil war, unquote, reads a statement on their website. The very same statement has been used to justify a recent rash of offenses currently being investigated by the UK police. Last Tuesday, railway services were severely disrupted in Bristol, a prominent city in England's southwest, after cables were set on fire. Their perpetrators had to remove protective concrete slabs to access the lines. It followed an attack on April 11th when several police stations in the same area were forced off the air. A police radio broadcasting mast on Dundry Hill was also damaged. That FAI statement said it specifically chose targets in Bristol, as the Ministry of Defense has located several installations nearby for the Olympics. A local business park of military industry companies such as Raytheon, Thales, and Kinetic Q. It's a weird name. Can also be found there. Quote, if they are serious about trying to disrupt the Olympics by using simple techniques such as these, they are capable of causing utter havoc, unquote, admits a private security consultant. The Olympic security bill tops 1 billion euro, that's about 1.6 billion, with the Royal Air Force in London's airspace promising to shoot down passenger jets if required. Troops armed with surface-to-air missiles and warships will also be in place to do battles on the Thames. Still, most of this is prevalent to Al-Qaeda-style terrorist attacks, not a low-intensity war, as promised by the FAI. Sabotaging UK transport system during July games, especially at another end of the country, has the potential of severely hampering travel during a critical period. But the FAI could go further than that, as they are also known for sending letter bombs to officials and carrying out drive-by attacks. In a recent instance, two motorcyclists shot a chief executive of a nuclear power company in the kneecaps in the Italian city of Genoa a fortnight ago. And we're going to another tune here on the Smash the State Report. And we're going to listen to a little Caballo and the Motherfuckings. Pow Wow Bounce, AWOL Radio. Oh,
high like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make them all day. I'll get one down in a second if you wait. Sometimes I feel sitting on trains. Every stop I get to, I'm clocking that game. Everyone's a winner, now I'm making that fame. Bonafide hustler, making my own name. All I wanna do is bang, 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 bang. And I'm ka-ching, and I take your money. All I wanna do is bang, 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 bang. And I'm ka-ching.
That's Pedal Pushers with Paper Planes. This is AWOL Radio. Smash the State Report. We're getting back into it. And Free Grassy. First Nations youth walk from Kenora to Toronto. Youth aim to raise awareness about mercury poisoning at Grassy Narrows First Nation. Six young people are making a 2,000-kilometer trek on foot from north of Kenora to Toronto to raise awareness about the legacy of mercury poisoning at Grassy Narrows First Nation. Quote, as a young person, I want to focus on the younger crowd and hope that one day they'll do something too to keep the message going, said one of the walkers, 17-year-old Edmund Jack, during a stopover in Thunder Bay on Tuesday. The pulp mill in Dryden dumped the toxins into the Wabigoon River decades ago. Jack said elders at Grassy Narrows still show symptoms of mercury poisoning. Quote, they're shaky. You talk to them. They'll look around and they'll have to look right at you to see you, he said. It's like they're almost blind. Gave me hope. Jack wants to be part of Grassy Narrows' campaign for environmental monitoring in the community because it seems like there are young people these days who don't really care about it. Jack's grandmother, Marianne Swain, is driving the support van carrying the walker's gear. She said she's proud of what they're doing. Quote, gave me hope that the youth are getting serious about the issues that are happening today, she said. The walkers plan to reach Toronto by June 4th. At the time, they'll join others at a rally, River Run 2012, to call on the provincial government to protect their water and land from industrial logging. Check out more information on the Grassy River Run at freegrassy.org. Also on Facebook, River Run 2012. All the events are listed. It's going to be awesome. It's next week. Get on the bus locally. If you're from Kitchener-Waterloo area, you can get on a bus. Just contact Tammy at wperg.org. Now we have the second half of the video from the Enbridge protest, which took place a week and a half ago, or the protest at the Enbridge pipeline hearings. So this is the Toronto Media Co-op appreciates the contribution of the above video from Mike Roy and the Indigents of London, Ontario. And it's the Haudenosaunee People Speak to Enbridge Pipeline Hearing on May 23rd. Here it is.
A right to be involved in these decisions. They go right over our head like we're not even there. And that's wrong.
The Haudenosaunee people have not been consulted or accommodated. The Haudenosaunee Development Institute has sent a letter to the National Energy Board and to Enbridge themselves with concerns of the environmental impact, and they have not been consulted or accommodated, which is going against the Constitution and breaking Canadian law, breaking the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, breaking the Two Road Treaty, and many other treaties we have with British Crown and Canadian people, and all over the states. And Indigenous people have stood up against this, and we are standing in solidarity with all those Indigenous people all over Turtle Island that are standing up against this, these pipelines going through their territories. We are just one nation that is standing up against this in solidarity with those people, with our brothers and sisters out west. And we will continue to do that. This isn't the end. This is just the beginning.
So that was a video shot by Mike Roy down in London, Ontario. And in case you missed it, TMC co-editor Tim Groves covered the event and wrote an article called Pipeline Tar Sands Oil Through Ontario Protested. National Energy Board's hearing on Enbridge Pipeline Reversal shut down. Good article. We're not going to read it right now because we read it last week. Following up with that, another piece from Tim Groves. Members of Six Nations have called upon supporters to join them on May 29th in blocking a multi-billion-dollar renewable energy windmill project being planned by Samsung. The multinational corporation did not receive permission from the traditional Haudenosaunee government in Six Nations to proceed with the project. Development of the project has been stopped since the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council, the traditional leadership body of the Six Nations people, issued a cease and desist order in November 2011. However, last week, Samsung announced they would proceed with the project. Before they can begin construction, they must conduct an archaeological survey. Work on this survey recommenced today with a team of about 60 people working on the survey, and that was May 28th. Approximately 30 members of Six Nations attended the site and confronted the archaeological team. Only after surveying stakes were pulled from the ground did the archaeological team leave the area. However, they pledged to resume work on Tuesday the 29th. The OPP police arrived on the scene. Quote, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council is calling for all Haudenosaunee people and their allies to come together and make Samsung and their archaeologists working for them respect the cease and desist order, reads an email put out by Solidarity activists. Quote, you have this big movement fighting against the 1%. Samsung is that 1%, said Wes Elliott, a member of Six Nations, who was speaking to 30 people who gathered at an event on building relations between Six Nations and non-native people in southern Ontario. He urged supporters to join them at the site the next day. Quote, you have all these people talking on the internet. If you actually want to do something, then come down and help, unquote. The Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council has been in contact with Samsung since 2009 in relation to the project. However, the corporation refuses to acknowledge the jurisdiction of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. The Haudenosaunee Development Institute, an arm of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council, has informed Samsung that they would be required to fill in a paperwork on the impacts of the project and pay the $7,000 application fee. However, both Samsung and the Ontario government asked HDI to change the name from an application fee, as that name would acknowledge the jurisdiction of the Confederacy over the land. HDI refused to change the name. Samsung had one sit-down meeting with HDI, but has since then opted to dealing with only the Six Nations Band Council. Elliott explained to the TMC why the Band Council is not the representative of Six Nations. Quote, the elected council was in our territory is supported by about 4% of the people, evidenced by the amount of people who vote in elections. The band council is a creature of the Indian Act, created in our territory in 1924. Our confederacy is over 1,500 to 2,000 years old. The proposed development would take place in the area included in the 1701 treaty between the Six Nations Confederacy and the Crown. Now, to follow up with that, some really interesting discussion around environmental justice, indigenous rights, and environmental racism has come up on the Toronto Media Co-op. And you know, while we have this discussion, we then get into the next big piece. And that next big piece is reported by the Toronto Sun, of all people, first. Well, direct action gets the goods. Samsung has agreed to pay the $7,000 application fee demanded by land defenders and traditional Confederacy Council after they blockaded from starting the work. Quote, Samsung Renewable Energy would like to once again express its willingness to continue a meaningful engagement by making the payment of the application fee as required by the Haudenosaunee Development Institute, President Li Xiong-tak wrote in a letter dated on Wednesday. Continuing, the application form and payment in favor of HDI in the amount of $7,000 are enclosed. Well, there it is. Direct action gets the good. We'll see how it works out from there. Moving on the Smash the State report, one last piece, and this is Support Flower, Stop the Criminalization of Six Nations Land Defenders, and it's a statement from the April 28th Coalition. On Tuesday, May 29th, Francine Flower Doxtator, a Haudenosaunee land defender and grandmother and member of the April 28th Coalition, appeared in court in Cayuga, Ontario, as a result of charges stemming from an incursion by Gary McHale and the OPP at Gonestaunton, the Six Nations reclamation site in Caledonia. In February 18th, 2012, as Flower and a group of about 15 of her supporters left the courtroom, they were approached in the lobby by a group of OPP officers, one of whom grabbed Flower by her broken arm and tried to rearrest her. Flower and her supporters were outraged and demanded to know what the new charges were. After a tense discussion in the lobby of the courthouse, the officers finally explained that they have evidence that Flower had been present at Gonestaunton on April 28th during the walk for peace, respect, and friendship, and that because this constituted a breach of her conditions, they were going to charge and arrest her. They claimed that by being at Gonestaunton on April 28th, Flower had breached conditions stemming from charges of February 18th when anti-Native rights activist Gary McHale marched onto Gonestaunton. Escorted by OPP officers, McHale had succeeded yet again in instigating conflict by unexpectedly marching towards the house at Gonestaunton and disturbing the Haudenosaunee people living there. As tensions rose, charges were laid against several Six Nations land defenders for allegedly obstructing and assaulting OPP officers. After she was arrested in late April on charges relating to the February 18th alleged incident, restrictive bail conditions were placed on Flower aimed at preventing her from standing up for Six Nations land rights. Serious procedural and legal issues abound about the manner in which those bail conditions were imposed on Flower, and she intends to challenge those conditions on a number of different grounds. Because of the powerful stand made by Flower and her friends and allies in the lobby of the courthouse on May 29th, the Crown agreed to discuss the matter with Flower and her supporters. As a result of the discussion that followed, the court was reconvened to hear this matter and to review Flower's bail conditions. This intervention led to a decision by the courts that although she would technically be rearrested in the courtroom and charged with a breach of her conditions, Flower would be released immediately with a Toronto-based QP 3903 member acting as her surety. While the police and court system have again criminalized Flower for exercising her treaty rights and refused to allow her to return to Gonestaunton, a victory was nonetheless won as supporters stopped Flower's incarceration. However, we must continue to build support for Six Nations land defenders and resist the actions of the colonial courts in criminalizing Six Nations land defenders. Flower is still not legally allowed to return to Gonestaunton, and in order to avoid jail, she has agreed to live with her surety in Toronto, away from her home, her community, her friends, her daughter, and her four grandchildren. All of us living on this land are treaty people, and we as treaty people must overcome such outrageous and heartbreaking violations of treaty and human rights by building support for our friends and allies at Six Nations. In terms of a legal strategy, money is urgently needed in order to hire a lawyer to overturn Flower's restrictive bail conditions, appoint a new surety from Six Nations, and lift the condition stating that she cannot reside at her home on Gonestaten. Because the Crown refuses to change these conditions, they must be appealed to a higher court. This will require raising money to pay for transcripts of Flower's previous hearings, as well as $3,000 to $5,000 in legal costs for the court challenge. The April 28th Coalition is asking for your help to support Flower in a number of ways. Pass a motion within your union or political organization denouncing this political repression of Indigenous land rights activists. Invite Flower and other members of April 28th Coalition to come and speak to your group about her case and the larger issues of Six Nations land rights and activism in support of treaty rights. Raise money to help cover the legal costs of appealing the court's decision to ban Flower from Gonestaten. Send money to help Flower cover the cost of replacing the glasses the police broke while arresting her, and to aid with her living costs while she is in Toronto. Come to Flower's next court appearance at 2 p.m. on June 26th in Cayuga, Ontario. Get involved in the April 28th Coalition. Email april28thinfo@gmail.com to get in touch with us and to tell us how you can help with any of these matters. Checks can be made payable to First Nation Solidarity Working Group and mailed to care of Laura Lepper, 193 Tansley Road, Thornhill, Ontario, L4J2Y8. You can also donate money via credit card or PayPal by clicking on the Donate button at the april28.net website. In solidarity, the April 28th Coalition. And again, support Flower, stop the criminalization of Six Nations land defenders. April28coalition.wordpress.com. And we gotta go to another tune. AWOL Radio here, 100.3 Sound FM, Waterloo, Ontario, CKMS. We've been having some technical issues at the station recently. If you want to help out with donating brand new computers, we could definitely use that help. Or tens of thousands of dollars. Either way, we could definitely use your help. So here we go with a new tune. Well, newish tune from Anti-Flag, The Ranks of the Masses Rising.
Time's up, you're out of luck, and your back's up against the wall. From Tunisia to Washington, the people are calling no. Your gas and guns, your clubs and thugs, your lies on the TV. None of that can save you now, as your reign is swept away. Get up, your voices are needed. Become the pulse of the revolution. In the ranks of the masses rising. Get up, your voices are needed. Become the pulse of the revolution. In the ranks of the masses rising. A breath and lit a match. She said, I will go down to Tahrir Square and I will stand alone. And if you have any dignity, I won't be on my own. Get up, your voices are needed. Become the pulse of the revolution and the ranks of the masses rising. Get up, your voices are needed. Become the pulse of the revolution and the ranks of the masses rising.
Hey!
Little Lanny Flag here, AOL Radio, Sound FM 100.3.